Welcome to Software Gone Wild, a podcast in which we discuss real-life network programming and SDN solutions. Just in case you stumbled upon this recording by accident, I'm Ivan Pipelnyak, blogging at ibspace.net, and with me today is Jason Edelman, the networking engineer who is actually responsible for the name of the podcast. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks, Ivan. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's so great to finally be able to do a podcast with you. I mean, you are the guy who started driving this whole network automation thing in at least the blogging space.
Yeah, I can't take that. Sounds like it's too much credit to be had, but there's plenty of folks out there that have been driving this as well.
No, but, you know, from people that I regularly read, you were probably the first one that started to write about this.
Cool. You know, again, not one to take back a credit, but yeah, no, it's been a pleasure over the past, yeah, anywhere from a year to year and a half, you know, driving this space. You know, there's been plenty of guys. I always mention, you know, Jeremy Schulman, formerly of Juniper, now at Sprockets. But, you know, for me personally, he's been, you know, sort of a motivating factor there and helped me tremendously along the way. But, yeah, I hope a lot of folks out there are reading my stuff, and I'm having a great time, you know, focused on programmability and automation.
By the way, for people who don't know where to read your stuff, where can they find your stuff?
Sure. So I blog at jedelman.com, and on Twitter, I'm jedelman8.
And you're probably more on Twitter than I am, because I just reply to tweets sent to me and nothing else.
Yeah, a little bit more than you.
So how did this whole thing start? How did you stumble upon the network automation niche, if you wish?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I didn't have network automation necessarily in mind, although I did know I wanted to at some point be able to combine some level of programming and automation with the network. So it probably goes back around, at this point, you know, might be a year and a half. I can go back and probably check some blog posts, but I knew I wanted to get into the space, and I hadn't programmed in, you know, 15 years, and I still live near my local university. So I ended up reaching out, you know, to a few folks there on LinkedIn, and ended up, you know, paying some students to get some, you know, what I would call, you know, cheap tutoring. And, you know, it started slow, you know, doing things like, you know, things in Java, you know, building, you know, config builders, reading data from an Excel sheet, creating, you know, config templates and things like that. But, you know, it slowly increased from there, where I realized, you know, I bounced around from different languages, and then, you know, first was Java. And then I realized I need to do some more, you know, web programming, because if I was ever going to build a platform that others would use, it would need to have some sort of, you know, so-called sexy interface. And then from there, I spent some time in, you know, PHP, HTML, things like that. I ended up building, you know, an internal tool for my last employer that, you know, calculated professional services dollars. And it had just a lot of formulas, you know, a lot of if-then statements, you know, a few loops and things like that. But, you know, the bottom line is that was totally unrelated to networking. And I was still at that point just trying to ramp up, you know, some different skill sets that I, you know, that in my head, I just knew I'd use down the line somewhere else. And then from there, sort of, you know, dove into, you know, 1PK from Cisco, and, you know, more into Python after the Python SDK from Cisco came out. And this is where it started to kind of integrate with, you know, my day job, as well as integrate more with, you know, what's now being called network automation or programmability. And, you know, it's just, you know, based on doing demos for customers, it sort of started to, and internally started to kind of, you know, see, you know, what was starting to make sense based on what I was working on.
So initially you were trying to do the same thing that every one of us invented at some point in our careers, a template builder.
That's where it all started. Exactly. Because, you know, when I was working with this tutor, you know, they were actually, you know, they're still a student in school, so they really didn't know networking at all. So it was, you know, in their eyes, they didn't know that I wanted to kind of make it relevant. And it was basically, you know, I just wanted to kind of cover the basics. How do I read from a file? How do I do, you know, how do I, you know, output to a file? How do I, you know, do this and do that? And then, you know, once you understand some of that stuff, then you can kind of, you know, tailor it to your needs. And that was the first thing that I actually did. And it wasn't even a full config. It was basically maybe 10 columns in an Excel sheet. Each column was like host name, you know, VLAN, you know, SNMP, community strings, things like that. And then, you know, click go, and then, you know, generated, you know, X amounts of configs.
Oh, nice. So effectively, you decided to start learning programming, and instead of writing Hello World, you wrote a templating program.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's a networking engineer's approach if I've ever seen one.
Yeah. No, it was good. And then from there, you know, again, you know, looking at some of the things that I had worked on, and I actually lost some of this code, which is unfortunate. But, you know, one of the things that I, you know, wrote about, you know, I guess sometime last year was, you know, it was, you know, the first app that I built for 1PK, and I was calling it Network Control Manager or NCM, and it was a 1PK application, actually two-tiered. You know, 1PK app was written in, you know, Groovy, you know, similar to Python, but it leveraged the Java libraries for 1PK and then a Python, a CLI client. And I was trying to build like this global CLI for all these network devices. And again, it was partly to prove that, you know, I could do it, and two, that, you know, there, you know, newer tools were needed in the industry. But again, there are so many questions that, you know, I had now to give demos to, you know, tools like this internally to customers. And it was just like, well, you know, who's gonna deploy, you know, Jason Edelman's code? And you kind of get these blank stares a little bit, and you sort of go back to the drawing board and see, well, you know, what else may work? And then from there, you sort of dabble in other things. And, you know, I think after the application, then I was starting to, at that point, you know, go down to demo things in like the Python shell, right? To do, you know, basic small scripts. But even in doing that, I was still getting very, you know, similar, you know, looks from, you know, people, from coworkers and customers. And it was just, you know, 'cause at the time, you know, I was, you know, for the most part, a design engineer who, you know, I wasn't doing deployments day to day. So it was just, you know, how do we actually, you know, bottle this up? And so it was still the same thing, no matter if it was a full blown application with, you know, over 1,000 lines of code versus small little scripts. It was just, who's going to maintain them? And that's sort of at the, you know, the pivot point, like for me, when I sort of started going down the path of like some of this, you know, so-called DevOps stuff, right? So I'll pause there for a second.
So has anyone then actually started using one of these early solutions of yours, or did it always stop at, well, yeah, it's a nice demo, but no, we think we'll do current paste?
Yeah, the things that I've built, there's still nothing, you know, being used by others. You know, I was trying to iterate demos and get feedback, right? So, and again, this ranges from customers and coworkers, and, you know, there's always, you know, varying feedback, and trying to find, you know, the right workflow for the, you know, the so-called, you know, killer app. But yeah, so the short answer is, you know, they're not being used, but I was just trying to, you know, solicit a lot of feedback to really understand, you know, what could be adopted and, you know, what could be used by others out there, fairly easily.
So you were effectively trying to figure out what could potentially work.
Exactly.
Now, as you've spent like a year and a half on this journey, what did you discover? What could potentially work from the tooling perspective, from the programming languages perspective, from the API perspective? If someone would want to build something today, where should they start?
So from a programming standpoint, you know, right now, my recommendation, you know, would be Python. That's largely consensus right now out there. And again, I'll always say I'm not a so-called expert in development methodologies or, you know, a lot of this space, but, you know, I've bounced around, you know, again, 18 months isn't a long time at all, but, you know, various languages, you know, three or four of them. And it, you know, really is about, you know, the principles that you would learn. But in terms of the use, when you look at things like OpenStack, and again, I've written a lot about Ansible and other tools, and some of these tools now are native Python. So, you know, it's just a, you know, easier language to get started in. And once you do, then you can, you know, fairly easily, you know, build, for example, you know, a small little, you know, widget or module that, you know, does something, you know, on the network. But, yeah. So I would definitely recommend, in terms of, you know, that programming space, you know, would be around Python. That said, in terms of, and you mentioned recommendation to go build something, this was a learning process for me, where, you know, I mentioned that NCM application based on 1PK that I was building. And I think when I stopped, it was, you know, multiple classes, you know, maybe northwards up to 2,000 lines of code. And again, you know, you can't, you know, we can't expect, you know, guys with day jobs to be doing this. You know, I burned, you know, a lot of my time over a period of 2 to 3 months to do this. So I think we need to, you know, define what that is for, you know, a user, you know, versus a tool builder, you know, but I do think, you know, some of the current DevOps tools, you know, fit that gap. And I've written about this where, you know, it's great because, you know, if you're a sysadmin, and I use Ansible as the example because, you know, I have most experience with that so far. If you're a sysadmin and you need to automate, you know, installing packages on Linux, or you need to, you know, update users and groups and all these different things, you know, within, let's say, Ubuntu, you can actually probably download Ansible and then be off and never write a line of code. But, you know, while you're using that framework, it still follows, you know, some of the same principles in terms of, you know, iterating through a list that, you know, to more efficient code and, you know, building templates, you know, within a tool. So instead of building your own templating engine, instead of, you know, writing your own application, you now leverage, you know, their framework and, you know, essentially, you know, leverage the modules, what they call modules, you know, pre-built to, again, do things like install packages. The underlying dilemmas now for where we are as networking professionals are there's still a lack of those so-called modules for the network space. So ultimately, if a sysadmin was using Ansible to do things like install packages, they can leverage, you know, out off of the shelf modules that do things like that, right? Change user permissioning, update users, install packages, and, you know, essentially control the operating system, you know, of different Linux distributions. Now the dilemma really comes in when, you know, guys like us, networking professionals, want to leverage these platforms, because these platforms were built from the ground up essentially for compute and cloud. And now you have networking professionals seeing, oh, there's actually a lack of tool sets out there in terms of automation platforms and automation frameworks. So now we're trying to, you know, build custom modules, right? And I think this is a step in the right direction. You know, is this the end game for network automation? You know, maybe, maybe not. You know, it's too early to say, but I would say if you take a framework like Ansible, then you can actually leverage their framework, which, you know, solid framework. And then if you were to build a custom module in Python, and this could be anything from 20 lines of code, 30 lines of code, 50 lines of code, it could be a lot more than that if an engineer wants to build, you know, a robust, you know, so-called module. But the bottom line is you don't have to. I would say in the ideal world, you don't have to build any. But again, since there's a lack of them out there today that integrate with a platform like Ansible, then, you know, for a person like me who wants to, you know, configure something or automate something with their framework, then I would have to actually launch a Python shell or build a Python application that does what I need and then integrate it. So the bottom line is, I think these tools are, you know, a great learning step for a lot of network professionals to see how they operate and to see, you know, how they integrate together. But, you know, I would expect to, you know, to see now, you know, again, more platforms and tools going forward that specifically, you know, focus on the network. That way, the network engineers don't actually have to go write any code going forward.
For people who are not that familiar with Ansible, for example, a sysadmin that wants to install a new server, install packages, start services, create users, create directories and files, doesn't have to do any programming. He just goes to Ansible website, he downloads the base software, he downloads some additional module he needs, and then he can start writing, what's it called, in Ansible playbook, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And he doesn't have to do any programming because someone else did all the programming for him, because people have encountered similar problems before. Whereas in networking, no one did that previous work for us. So if you want to start with Ansible, you effectively start at zero. Is that correct?
Exactly. So I would say, you know, for me right now, I was working with Cisco devices. So I was starting at ground zero. So I'm saying, you know, in myself, you know, how do I actually use this to integrate with, you know, 1PK routers. So it was literally ground zero. You know, I was using the Ansible framework, but wasn't using, you know, many of the, you know, pre-built modules. Now, if you look, you know, within the past 2 weeks or so, you know, there have been some vendors, you know, Arista, Cumulus, and Juniper have all contributed code, you know, upstream. And now I think they're part of what they call Ansible Galaxy. And so, users could download some of that to get started. Then you can say, you know, with Arista, you know, create interface, you know, delete interface, create port channel, and do things like that. And again, you know, right now from a network perspective, even if it's those three vendors, you know, they might have, you know, half a dozen, maybe a dozen modules. But if you look at, you know, Ansible Core in terms of what they offer for, you know, sysadmins, it likely is in the hundreds or more modules. So you can look at the discrepancy in terms of, you know, the orders of magnitude of the focus area of these companies. And again, not just Ansible, it's like Ansible, Puppet, Chef, a lot of these companies where their, you know, their primary focus, you know, is, you know, this, you know, compute and cloud world. And, you know, now networking vendors are starting to, you know, to latch onto some of these platforms.
Yeah. But on the other hand, we've been doing this stuff, or at least people in larger quantities have started doing this stuff maybe for the last 6 months, whereas the sysadmins were doing this for 10 years.
Exactly.
So yeah, we have some catch up to do.
Yeah, we do. It'll be good. And again, if there's folks out there that have had, you know, there's, you know, native Python scripts, you know, I know Perl's been around for a long time, but using, again, Python as the example, if somebody's been, you know, writing a Python, it could be even a Python expect script. You know, I wouldn't advocate that, right? In modern devices that have better interfaces, but you can very easily convert a Python script to be an Ansible module. And then just as, you know, within Puppet, right? You know, Puppet is based on Ruby. So, you know, similarly, it's just a matter of, you know, finding the right tools that, you know, fit, you know, the requirements and the needs. And, you know, because again, you know, Ansible, they gave, you know, a short overview, but, you know, Ansible, unlike other tools, you know, doesn't require an agent on the device. You know, it just makes a lot of sense for networking, you know, legacy devices, at least because, you know, I would say there's billions of dollars of kit out there and, you know, you can't very easily load a software agent or, you know, a piece of software on, you know, let's say, you know, the router to control it as some tools, you know, want you to do. But again, with an agentless based tool, you know, then you could connect that device, you know, via, you know, newer APIs as, you know, the OS gets upgraded on those platforms.
So yet again, to look at the slightly bigger picture, if I understand correctly, Ansible doesn't need anything on the device. So Ansible just calls some local module in some local library, and that local module has to use whatever mechanism to connect that device and execute the action on that device. And in Linux space, that's obviously SSH, and you could potentially use SSH with expect scripts even on a really old Cisco iOS, right?
So it's an interesting question, good question. And so, yeah, natively, you know, it is using SSH to connect to a Linux server, but, you know, what's happening is it's connecting via SSH, and then it's, you know, dropping in a piece of Python code that would be executed, and then it would remove the code, you know, once the job is done executing. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why you still likely wouldn't use SSH. So, you know, SSH, you know, the way they use it today, but yeah, you could use SSH to connect and leverage, you know, expect scripting as well to do that. So, you know, it's sort of, it depends based on where it's being implemented.
Mm-hmm. Of course. But let's say this is the least common denominator that we've been using for the last 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, again, if somebody can write a Python script and use expect, then that in theory could be a module in something like Ansible. Yeah.
Not the best way, not the preferred way, but it can get an old Nortel PBX to work.
Yeah, and that's the thing where, you know, in term, especially, you know, us folks that are, you know, on Twitter or, you know, write a few blogs here and there, but you know, you really have to differentiate if you're going to, you know, build something to scale, you know, build something to learn, right? And again, I've said, you know, in a lot of my journey, I've learned a tremendous amount, and it keeps the picture gets a little clearer by the day on where we should be going. So in terms of, you know, if you had a large scale data center or, you know, a large scale WAN or even, you know, 50 routers on the WAN, do you want to manage that with expect? Maybe not, but in terms of if you were in a lab environment and you were at ground zero with some technologies, I would have no issue saying, you know, use Python, use expect, and use Ansible to learn it. You know, if you had no equipment at all that supported modern APIs from, again, Cisco, Arista, Juniper, what have you. And, you know, if that was the lowest common denominator, I would say, you know, go for it because it would be a great learning experience and things would be that much easier, you know, once there was a better API deployed on those devices.
So I guess with Arista, you would say use EAPI today?
Yeah. As far as I know, it would be EAPI with Arista. They just posted new modules for Ansible, and I haven't checked to see how they're connecting. to the device, but I would expect that to be the API.
And just for people who haven't really looked into eAPI, it's CLI commands repackaged in JSON format, so they are easier to parse for the computers. And you get an error message back, so you don't have to do the expect scripting with the parsing of the error messages.
Yep.
Now, Cisco would be 1PK probably, right?
It depends. You know, Cisco, as we know, there's multiple device types.
Oh, yeah, that's true. There's ASA.
Well, no, so I would say even within, I would look at Cisco potentially, the easiest to, articulate it would be maybe looking at it from a WAN perspective and data center perspective. So WAN, if it's, ISR, G2 routers, 1900s, 3900s, and everything in between, and, a lot of these devices now, including ASR 1000s, even the CSR 1000B actually, a lot of these devices are supporting 1PK. So, 1PK, would be a great option there. And then when you look at, Nexus, anything from 9K, 7K, and below, 9Ks today support NX API, which is actually very similar to how you described eAPI from Arista. So NX API, would be the way, forward within data center, and then, 1PK potentially within WAN and campus. But again, it depends on the platform support. So it's just, some of those things to go out and check.
And older versions of iOS, for example, didn't support 1PK. So what would you use there?
If it's a Cisco device and, hypothetically, if it's a router or a legacy device, the only option would be, would be some sort of expect script.
So you haven't played with NetConf on Cisco iOS?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay. So I have not personally, no.
It's like CLI with wrappers.
Right.
Because you have to pass the CLI commands and you get the CLI printouts and you have to parse them manually, but at least you get the XML tags around them if that helps you any.
Yeah, I've seen some of the work on from Juniper, and I think their interface is XML based using that conf.
That one is way better because they actually think in XML, not in text.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, their interface isn't too shabby.
Yeah, so with them, you actually get an XML document back that you can parse using any XML parser. And then you go and inspect the data structure and you see what you got back. You don't have to do the screen scraping like with Cisco iOS.
Exactly. Yep.
So we covered 1PK, we covered Ansible. Anything on Puppet that you want to share?
So I recently dove into Puppet a little bit. Still wanna dive in, a bit further, only because they recently announced a large round of funding, focused on networking and storage to try to bring these pillars together of compute, cloud, networking, and storage. So I think again that tells industry that there's been a lack of network integration, right, to some of these DevOps tools. Again, I've spent a lot more time with Ansible than I have with Puppet, but, both tools, seem to have, a good audience. Puppet's, user base is a lot greater because it's been around for a lot longer. But, some comments on using Puppet, Puppet, maybe it's a history, but it follows more of a, programming usage and mentality where using the example, if you're, in Python and you're developing a class, you might have like a constructor and use, init within Python. Puppet has things, they use init quite often. Puppet uses a lot of include statements, right? They use a lot of, modules and classes and things like that. And, I think if you're an avid Puppet user, it probably makes, a lot of sense. And I've spent maybe, a week with it. And, things are starting to sink in. So, I hate, advocating for one tool or the other, right? But again, Puppet is agent based. I think with a programming background, Puppet would be able to be picked up quite a bit. But I would say from a just, a quick learning curve, quick, road to adoption, Ansible for me, it was just, very easy to get going. Again, not agentless. It didn't require, something like a Puppet Master or a separate machine. You literally can load Ansible on any machine and run your, those playbooks from any device in your environment. But, I think, Puppet agents are now being used on, for example, like Nexus 9000s at Cisco and other platforms in the future. So there's definitely a target market. It's just a matter of, really trying to see, what can be done. And like I was saying earlier, comparing those two still, where, like for me, you know, 1PK has a Python SDK. So then I was driven to use that, and that fit very well into what I was doing with Python scripting and Ansible modules, where with Puppet, you know, it's largely based on Ruby. And so I haven't dug in far enough, but, you know, it would seem to me you would need to use Ruby to extend Puppet if you wanted to build your own sort of custom modules. And because it's agent-based, you know, building custom, what they call provider types, is a bit more complex than I think it would be on Ansible. So it's just some of these things to look at. But both companies seem to be doing fairly well.
And just a note of caution, yes, every vendor is promising or delivering Puppet Agent on their devices these days. But what you really have to ask yourself is, what can those agents do? And in most cases, they can just configure a VLAN.
Well, exactly. And I think it's very similar. Even we mentioned, you know, Cumulus, Arista, and Juniper pushing modules to Ansible. And that's this, you know, again, there could be a half a dozen or a dozen. You know, it's likely a little less, you know, with Puppet because, you know, you require the agent, but I agree 100%. It's just, you know, if you're going to do an RFP, make sure you have your goals in mind versus does it support a Puppet agent? Because, you know, if all Puppet can do is configure, you know, sometimes it's configure a VLAN, configure an interface, you know, maybe send a raw command down there to, you know, configure the device. You know, is that really, you know, beneficial to the end user and environment? So, but you know, good point.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even want to send a raw command down because I would like the code that does the configuration, whether it's on the device or whether it's just a module that Ansible uses, for example, I would want that thing to look at the state of the device first, figure out if it's safe to do the change, and then do the change and verify that the change has been done. Whereas if you just send a raw command down, well, what do you get?
Well, exactly. And here's the thing, you know, this is, you know, from experience, you know, trying to develop some custom modules where you want to, you know, when you talk about declarative state and, you know, promise theory, all these different things. And I was trying to build modules that were, you know, themselves, you know, what they call, you know, idempotent. So idempotent means, you know, if the device is already in the desired state, don't change anything. You can make the same change 1,000 times and, you know, it's going to only make the change essentially once. You know, so basically, again, you know, a self-built module, you know, could do that check, but that's just more work. And this is where you get into the dilemma in terms of trying to, you know, leverage potentially existing DevOps tools, you know, for, you know, so-called NetOps. So these are some of the things that I think will evolve with, you know, verifying the device is in, you know, a proper state before making a change and things like that. But again, some of that, you know, could be done by a developer or, you know, a network admin if you want to put the work in. It definitely possible, but it just becomes more of a burden on, you know, on the network admin.
By the way, you mentioned promise theory. I don't think many networkers are familiar with that. So you want to go into more details?
You know, again, just basically, you know, the key points that I try to hit home on when discussing things like promise theory, you know, a lot of this, you know, came out with Cisco over the past few months, but, you know, basically is you want to make, you know, the device will promise that it will, you know, do something, you know, without the end user worrying about how. And again, if you look at, you know, something like, you know, again, some of these tools, you know, or, you know, like Puppet, say, you know, configure interface or, you know, ensure this user is on this server, you actually are using, you know, in that example anyway, you know, their specific language format, but it abstracts out the underlying how. And, you know, in networking, it's basically, you know, sort of forgetting about the commands and, you know, ensuring that, you know, hypothetically the interface is up or ensuring the description is on there. You know, you sort of, you know, take out the underlying details and really focus on the what and, you know, the implementation, the solution, you know, promises that it'll do it. Again, you just don't worry about how it gets done.
So effectively, let's say I want to configure a VLAN instead of thinking about Cisco IOS or Junos or Cumulus or Arista or whoever, I have a Puppet agent on every device that can do it, and I just send a command to that Puppet agent, well, configure this VLAN on this port. And that agent replies back, I promise I will do it somehow, and you don't want to know how, or it replies back, well, sorry, I can't do that.
Exactly. And the way you described it, right? So, you know, somebody has to have that translation because, you know, the goal is to allow the users not to have to think in CLI commands anymore per vendor. So in those examples, right? So Puppet would be doing that. And, you know, is Puppet doing that yet? You know, maybe with their new round of funding, but that's sort of like the underlying factor when you look at and compare some of these platforms that were purpose built for, you know, systems largely on Linux and, you know, versus networking. You know, with networking, there's just, you know, a large, you know, amount of, you know, popular vendors out there, and, you know, a proper platform, you know, should natively be able to translate that sort of thing where, you know, the user doesn't have to keep track of, you know, commands per vendor and, you know, different things like that. So.
By the way, now it occurred to me, have you ever played with TailF's, what's it called, NCS?
No, I've never played with it. I've seen a few demos, you know, and a lot of them looked slick, but have never had a chance to actually use it myself.
Because now I'm wondering, what's the difference between their tool and a properly implemented Ansible or Puppet environment?
No, that's good. It's a good question. And, you know, one of the things off the top of my head, just thinking about it, you know, one of the great things, you know, again, in some of these platforms are there are open source versions. So again, if that is important for extensibility, where, you know, again, if there's tens or hundreds of core modules, you know, how quickly is it or how possible is it to, you know, to extend, you know, the TailF platform? You know, maybe it's very possible, you know, maybe it's impossible and you have to pay them to do it. I don't know, but the extensibility would be another factor to look at when comparing some of these platforms.
Of course, it's all extensible. You just have to learn what's that thing called, Yank.
Yeah. right.
Oh, you learn Yank and all the problems just disappear automatically. Don't worry about that.
I'm taking a note right now. Learn Yank when we finish this podcast.
Not so fast. I don't think anyone else is using it at the moment.
Yeah, no, they have an interesting solution, right? And, you know, they have the, what was it, the N network, is it NCS or whatever? I forget the name you just mentioned.
I think it's NCS, yeah.
NCS. And then, you know, again, they had, you know, Compd, you know, on Box. And you sort of, when you look at that, you know, they had, you know, what looks like a controller or configuration manager, and they have, you know, sort of what exposes NetConf from the device to have a lot of that intellectual capital, you know, property. It would be interesting to see, you know, could that evolve into more of a, you know, tool to compare it to like a Puppet or Ansible? You know, it's a good question, and I guess we'll wait and see what Cisco does with them.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, coming back to the basics. Assuming I'm a networking engineer and I'm paired with a programmer who can actually do some real programming, so I don't have to stumble and try to learn Python or whatever using Google and students, where should I start?
So there's a few things that I would say. You know, one, again, Python for sure. And then Google actually has, you know, I think it's like a 2 or 3 day class online, and you can just, you know, go to the Google search and type in, you know, Google free Python training. And, you know, that's actually a, you know, pretty good place to start in terms of programming. You know, that was instructor led, and then there's even labs that go along with it. And then of course there's always, you know, the Code Academy and a few sites like that that have, you know, interactive, you know, prompts and shells on those sites. And that's, you know, a good foundation for, I would say, you know, some, you know, Python skills. But, you know, generically speaking, you know, I'm doing more work in this area in terms of training, but, you know, trying to, you know, take a step back, I would say, you know, Python is definitely a good start just to understand, you know, what it can do, and then look at, you know, how Python integrates with, you know, templating tools or templating libraries like Jinja 2 is one example. And again, if you combine, you know, Python and Jinja 2, then you can see how easy it is to build, you know, things like configuration templates and make it relevant for your day job. And then you have to, like, you know, just a small foundation. Like I would really, you know, look at device API. So no matter what vendor it is, you know, Cisco, Arista, Juniper, you know, what have you, you know, you can say, you know, Cumulus, but it, you know, they really don't have, you know, an API as far as I know. It's, you know, just native Linux. So you know, if you have a device that has an API or even a controller that has an API, then you just sort of, you know, take what you want in Python and say, hey, how do I actually, you know, extract a few things from this device? And, you know, I wouldn't go crazy with trying to push commands or trying to, you know, automate, you know, configs throughout a global enterprise, but, you know, it makes sense just to try to extract data. Even if it's extracting the host name or extracting the current iOS version or OS version, you know, that would be, you know, a great start. And then so that's sort of, you know, see those, you know, 2 or 3 things from like Python templating APIs. And then once, you know, you have that, or at any time, then you can kind of, you know, dive into, you know, you know, DevOps tool that allows you to customize it and, you know, sort of experience that interaction, you know, between some basic programming and some, you know, modern DevOps tools.
You just mentioned a very interesting aspect of these tools that is often forgotten. So we are all talking about how you can build templates, how you can configure devices and so on. But what you can also do is you can just run read-only collection scripts and collect data from those devices and then use Ansible, for example, for like a rudimentary health monitor, right?
You know, exactly. And that's one of the first workflows that I was trying to work with the customer on was, you know, extracting data, because, you know, there's just, you know, a lot of customers, a lot of users out there, you know, have, you know, a pretty little dashboard with green, amber, and red, but, you know, it's for the most part used to, you know, maybe report status down. That, you know, honestly, it's pretty common out there where any change that's still made via the CLI. So, you know, I have a customer that has a fairly large network. You know, it's not global by any means, but, you know, there's a few hundred nodes on the network. And, you know, whenever we'd be on the phone trying to figure stuff out, and even if it's, you know, this a small thing in terms of, let's say, a SmartNet contract upgrade and trying to verify serial numbers, or trying to, you know, that's one example of gathering some raw data. But if it was troubleshooting, like they had an issue where, you know, people always call in and say it's a WAN issue. And then, you know, we spent literally an hour and a half saying, well, you know, what do you actually do when there is a WAN issue? When someone that has no background in IT says, my computer is slow, you know, what do you do as a network engineer? And then, you know, again, you know, he rattled it off within like 5 minutes, but then I'm trying to take notes. So an hour and a half later, sort of, you know, it go to the, you know, current WAN router, look at show IP accounting and look at, you know, some top talkers there. Then you would, you know, sort of, you know, try to, you know, figure out what switch port they're plugged into by looking at ARP caches and MAC tables. So I would say like there's so much that can be done with extracting data from a device, where that would be a 100%, you know, where I would start. And it's still where a lot of what I'm doing is actually just trying to extract the right data from the right devices.
So effectively, you're saying you don't have to be a programmer, because hopefully you have someone else in your organization who's better at that, but you have to start thinking like a programmer. You have to formalize your troubleshooting steps and turn them into a process that any idiot could follow, and once you have the process that any idiot could follow, then you can automate that, right?
It would be a great first step, you know, if, you know, every person in network operations, you know, would really think through how they troubleshoot and how they configure. And, you know, again, every little step with opening an Excel file, checking your IPAM, checking InfoBox, checking all these things. But exactly, and that's the hard part in terms of trying to convey that. And, you know, one point on that, I really do think, you know, a lot of, you know, I don't want this to sound the wrong way, but, you know, a lot of vendors out there actually, and, you know, I worked at, you know, VAR for a long time, you know, even, you know, we've done really well, but, you know, there's very little interaction with how to best deploy and how to best support the network. And there's some managed services that, you know, abstract out some of those things, but you can look at those processes, and that makes the most sense to say, you know, you want to troubleshoot. And, you know, again, you know, due to, you know, fire drills, sometimes it's hard to do, but, you know, it's really a great process to go through. And it's pretty challenging too, to try to document it. But I would urge everyone to try to do that, is to pick, you know, one common task, you know, or one or two common workflows and try to document them. And hey, you know, send them over to you, send them over to me, and, you know, try to see what we can work up in, you know, some of these platforms to help them automate it.
Yeah, and once you have the workflow, then you can start automating that, including extracting the data from the devices, correlating, finding out things, going to other devices, extracting data, actually emulating someone who is doing some baseline troubleshooting. And if the tool gets stuck, it just throws an error saying, well, I collected these things and I'm stuck.
Exactly. Exactly. Perfect. Well said.
So effectively, now we just invented a tool that can, with proper implementation, replace the level one tech, right?
No, exactly. And I've written about this recently too, is, you know, I was at a local meetup on some of these platforms, and, you know, I think I was the only network person there. And, you know, it was a sysadmin that said, I never even thought about using these tools, you know, for networking. And as a sysadmin, he was just looking to get, you know, some basic config data out of the network. And it was just, you know, interface, you know, things like speed, duplex, and how it's configured. That way the server, you know, would match that properly. But instead, you know, he has to go to the network team, you know, to, you know, go into the device and get the data out and then get it back. And then what happens when the server guy needs that data for 100 ports or 10 ports or whatever the number is? So just read only for, you know, you can say level one, but, you know, in reality, it could be a senior level sysadmin or somebody who's not on the network team. So I think there's plenty of use cases there. But yeah, I think, you know, read only data and thinking through the process is, you know, is really the first step.
Oh, here's another good one now that you mentioned this. Turn on LDP, look into LDP on all your top of rack switches, find the server name, find the port number, extract information about that port, and present that to your sysadmin buddy.
Yeah, no, exactly. A lot can be done. You know, we're really at round zero in the space.
Okay, and on that note, let's wrap it up for today. So Jason, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about what you're doing?
So you can, I blog at jedelman.com and on Twitter at jedelman8s. And I'll also be speaking at Interop in New York in the upcoming month, again, on network automation.
Oh, that's true. We'll meet there.
Exactly. Look forward to that.
What other plans do you have for like next month or two? Anything else exciting that you're working on?
No, I'm going to continue writing about some of these topics. You know, I'm also, you know, developing, you know, working on some projects on developing, you know, training in this space. But yeah, that's pretty much it for now.
Perfect. So good luck with that. And thanks for joining me and see you in New York.
All right. Thanks, Ivan. Thanks for having me.
And well, you've heard, I'm Ivan Pieplniak and you can find me at ibspace.net or follow at iOS Hints if you really want to read my occasional Twitter rants. The show notes for this episode and all the others are at podcast.ibspace.net, where you also find a subscribe link. And if you want to know more about SDN, go to SDN resources page at ipspace.net/SDN. Finally, if you like this show, don't forget to go to iTunes and leave a review. We still don't have enough reviews for an average review, so do your job. And don't forget to follow this show at podcast.ipspace.net.